Peter Kerrigan, Reel 2.
Would we please sing Tipperary because they wanted to let the people know that here were volunteers that had come for the brigade who had come from Britain, from England. They talked about England, they didn't talk about Britain. So we did sing Tipperary, marching through Barcelona. Incidentally, one thing that I did notice, it's not possibly going into all details, but I did notice it was rather striking, the tram cars were painted diagonally red and black. This was the anarchist colours. And I was told, I didn't verify it myself, that apparently they were taking the fares and they were paying it to the anarchist trade union, you know, at that time. That was something, situation.
A detail. What was Barcelona like at that time? The anarchists, the CNT and the FAI, would be in control, wouldn't they?
Well, they were very powerful. They were very powerful. I wouldn't say they were in complete control, but it certainly, in the trade union movement, I think they exercised the predominance. But remember, we had only a short visit through, and we could only see superficially what was happening. And therefore, I wouldn't start to give a sort of political estimation of the situation. I only mentioned the thing about the tram cars because it was rather striking to somebody like me and I suppose the other lads as well.
Yeah.
The half of the car diagonally black and the other half diagonally red, you know.
Yeah.
And it was only, I was told, I didn't verify it myself because we didn't travel on the trams. Then we were put on the train again and we ended up at Albacete, which was the rallying point and headquarters of the International Brigades at that time. And there we were taken to the bullring, which was a sort of used as a kind of parade ground, and there was a short welcome address and that. And then uniforms were given, you know, that was a khaki-type uniform, a tight sort of elastic thing at the ankles, at the army boots, of course, berets, and a sort of greenish khaki coloured uniform. I was appointed, incidentally, the British officer who was in charge of the British at the village where our lads were sent to, not far, a few miles from Albacete, was Madrigueras. That was the headquarters of the battalion. And it was from there they did all their training. And the commander in charge at that time was Wilfred McCartney, a former British officer. The political commissar was D.F. Springall, who had served in the Royal Navy, also an active Communist Party member.
Now, just one second. Those sort of three people, Madrigueras, Springall, and McCartney, who had appointed them?
They had been appointed by the military command at the base.
By the Spanish military
command? Oh, yes. Well, no. The International Brigade military command. Mm. The man in charge at that time when I was there was André Marty.
He was in charge then?
Yes, oh. And he was assisted by another Frenchman called Vidal.
Yeah. And they were the responsible for creating the initial hierarchy?
There, as far as I could get.
And were there many people there when you got there, many British people?
Well, I was going to tell you about that.
Sorry, yes.
Already there were British volunteers there, including a British company that had already been formed and incorporated in a French volunteer battalion commanded by a French officer called LaSalle.
Yes.
The political commissar of that battalion, the whole battalion, was Ralph Fox, the English writer. He was a well-known writer, progressive writer. He was a member of the Communist Party. He'd been a university graduate, etc. And the company commander was a George Nathan, who had been an officer in the Brigade of Guards. He was the company commander. I think he had about the rank of a captain, you know, as the officer in charge of the British company. There were three other... I remember battalions there were about 600 odd men. It wasn't like the old 1,100 men battalions that we'd been used with in the British Army in the First World War. They were in the continental style, you know, yes. And a number of these things came up. I was appointed at the same time, when I arrived there, as the political commissar at Albacete base for all the English-speaking volunteers. Already some Americans had begun to arrive.
You were commissar of all the English-speaking ones?
That meant Americans as well, the base commissar for them all. Commissar.
Did that extend much further, or were you then just on the British later on?
Well, it continued for a period. I don't know, really, as I'll tell you. If you let me go through the thing, you'll okay. see. And then you can maybe question me on the other thing, you see. About mid-December, remember, it was early December when I got there, quite early, McCartney, the commander of the British battalion, you want to change?
No, it's all right.
McCartney, the commander of the sort of embryo British battalion, Tom Wintringham, who was his second in command, Frank Ryan, who was a well-known Irish revolutionary, and A. Springhall and myself were taken on a trip to Madrid, where we visited the front and met, among others, General Kleber. I don't know what his real name was. And there I made my first acquaintance with Hans Karl, who was a brigade commander of the IB. Later, Hans Karl came to Britain. He ended up as a military correspondent of the Daily Worker. And I think after the war, he went back to East Germany, and I think he became the chief of police in Mecklenburg. He died about 1947 with the stomach trouble, ulcers and that. He was a very, very fine person and a very expert at this kind of thing. Well, during our visit to the front, we were at the hospital, the University City, we were at Puan Caral, and here at Puan Caral, we came across a firing party for a funeral from a member of the Talman battalion that had been killed at Boadilla. And it turned out it was young Martin Messer, and I was asked to do the funeral oration for Messer. I must say later, I learned it was a terrible blow to his father. Of course, it was also a heavy blow because I had been with the boy, because he was only a boy, 19, on the hunger march. Later, we were very strict, and we sent home 18-year-olds when we found out their real age when they came, because they were supposed to be 21. And I repatriated later a number of young lads, a couple from Scotland as well. Just before Christmas, LaSalle's battalion moved off to the southern front near Cordoba. And I remember Springhall and I spending some time with Ralph Fox, having coffees and a talk as a sort of farewell in a little cafe there. A few days later, very few days later, after they had gone south, I was called to the brigade headquarters, and there was a sent with Gallo, that's Luigi Longo, who was later to be secretary of the Italian party, and now he's the president of the party, who was the sort of chief commissar at the base for all the brigaders there. I was sent off to the southern front. As apparently a very difficult situation had developed, and they were asking for say, some responsible people to go down and to inspect the situation and to report. Well, we went down, it was a quite long car journey, and we arrived at a small village not very far from Cordova called Lopera. As we approached the front, we were coming through trees. I was a bit worried because my interpreter was a young chap. He spoke French very fluently, about 18 or 19. He was a son of a Professor Haldane, or rather he was a son of the wife of Professor Haldane, Ronnie Burgess, I think was his name. And of course, when there are bullets coming and that, and you're thinking, well, what's happening, going to happen if this young fellow gets one? As we approached the front, coming through these trees, we saw the general. It turned out to be Walter. That was my first dealings with Walter. That's, he was Swizerski, the Polish, who became, deputy minister for war. And he was killed about 47 by Ukrainian nationalists and some fighting there. He was a quite fine, a little man, very capable and likeable person. I saw him talking to some of the French soldiers, the brigadier, the members of the brigade, who had obviously been coming back from the front. And I soon realized that what he was doing, he was trying to convince them to go back into the line. Because I spoke with his chief of staff, an Italian called Morandi, and he explained more fully that there had been very heavy fighting, that the fascist troops were occupying a high ridge, that we were down below them, our troops, and that they had avion and we didn't have any. Anyway, we never saw Lasalle's. I learned later that his battalion headquarters was back behind the divisional headquarters that Walters had, further back from the front. And when we got up to the front line, we discovered it was an olive grove. Now, you know what olive trees are like. Well, they were dug in, or theoretically supposed to be dug in, small, shallow holes behind rather thin little trees, well, you know, like an olive tree is, even a very well-developed one. At least I presume you do.
Yes.
And there we had the company headquarters of the British company, and Nathan was in charge, and everything was under control. He told us there had been very heavy fighting, unfortunately, they had had to make attacks over open ground with the fascists with machine guns pinning them down. There had been quite a few casualties, and Ralph Fox had been killed. And he said that he gave me Ralph Fox's papers that they'd taken off the body, but they hadn't been able to get the body in. But he promised me that that night they would get the body in. Now, I then saw really effectively, because I had nothing to do with that French company there, the French battalion, I saw the kind of rifles they were using, old Austrian Steyr, S-T-E-Y-R, I think, I don't know if you call them Steyr or Steyr, rifles that were at least pre-1914 war. Because you couldn't put a clip in a magazine, you had to feed each individual bullet into the breech, you know, thumb it in. And you can understand what that meant in a war of this kind. So that was just one of the difficulties that they had. Well, I was then sent to another part of the front where there was some to inspect the area and to make estimates of the situation, and met there the machine gunners from the Dombrowski Polish battalion.
Just one question on this point. You were here simply with your interpreter. I mean, the British hadn't been committed to battle at that
point. Oh, they had. That's why Fox had been killed. He was one of the casualties. They had been trying to take the hill.
I see.
They had been pinned down. The French on their the French companies that were in each side of them were now a back of them, as a matter of fact, those that were still in the line, and there were some had they obviously deserted from the front when I saw him.
And some of the people you come across with were in that battle on the Corps de the Front?
Oh, yes. Yeah. All the members of the number one company were already in action as part of this battalion. It suffered pretty heavy casualties. I don't know how heavy.
Yeah.
And we had lost people in the English or British section.
Yeah. Further question, you talk about these Frenchmen fleeing. I understand that at this point, LaSalle, in fact, he fled, did he not, from the battle?
Well, he disappeared for a period anyway. I never saw his headquarters, and therefore I can't verify exactly where he was. But I'll tell you what happened about him. I went to this other part of the front. It took some time, and I stayed the night at one place, in the line, but in some place, just a house or something there. They were in pretty good shape, the machine gunners and that, and I think they had been all had military service before they had been there as well, you know. They were Polish anti-fascists. Anyway, we decided to come back the next day to rejoin up with the British and finalise our arrangements there. When we got back, they weren't in the line. They had been drawn out during the night. Now, I didn't know at that time they were going to Madrid. We're told they'd been sent to Madrid. That was correct, but it wasn't as literally correct as I understood it to be, because what had happened apparently had been taken out of the line, the battalion had been pulled together and regrouped, you see, and they stayed a night at the southern front, but back from the front. Some battalion had replaced this battalion. It was obvious they were trying to get them sort of sorted out. But they were taken away, I think it was the next day, right to Madrid. And by the way, very shortly after that, they were put into action again in Madrid, because I know that when the British came back. But that meant we missed them. I learned then that LaSalle had been arrested, but it wasn't until a little while later that I learned that the court-martial had taken place and he had been shot. I understood at the time he was shot for cowardice. But later then there were stories about him being a fascist agent. They had been discovered. Now, as a matter of fact, there are two comrades here who actually were put on guard when LaSalle was arrested, when Walter gave the order, two of the brigaders.
Levine?
Eh?
Levine, is he called?
Ah, that's right. Morris from Manchester area,
right.
I think it is. Anyway, you can speak to him if you want to about that. And that, because they know the bit that I couldn't fill in. See?
What did you feel about that, him being shot?
Well, I thought that probably it was the only thing that could be done with a man, because in my opinion, the action of the commander at that time of course, I wasn't involved in the actual trial and so on, but if you ask my opinion, I would say that the way the soldiers had, because I'm quite sure those soldiers were, how shall I put it, a bunch of cowards, but I believe that they had been to some extent demoralized by the action of the commander. He couldn't have been in touch with them.
Okay.
Well, anyway, that was basically what happened in the Southern Front. I returned to Albacete and then to the part doing my time between Albacete and Madrigueras in connection with the battalion. Now, I had been advocating very strongly that we should get a British battalion established as quickly as possible. There were people keep coming out, the 120 that I had got, there were a few that hadn't been put into the a company that was in the French battalion,
yeah.
Because there had been some had come after they had been incorporated in that battalion. And about mid-January, the number one company came back from the Madrid front. And partly for a rest, and also to be the basis, the nuclei around which would be built the battalion.
Yeah.
And the battalion took shape almost immediately around them. Some had had some training there, and the British battalion had been blooded, the British company, number one company as it was called, had been blooded both in the Cordoba front as well as the Madrid front,
yes.
Because they'd been in action in Madrid.
There were about 18, weren't there, in the Madrid front, as I understand, 18 British people.
Well, there had been a group. Now, let's be clear, we're not talking about the number one company. The number one company went there, there would be anything up to, well, slightly less than 100 with the casualties.
Yeah.
But there had been groups there.
Yes,
for instance, there was a Messer, he was with the Talmans, there were a few more like that. There was a few also with what was called, what we knew as the Dumont Battalion, a French battalion of the International Brigade that were all at the Madrid front. And there were some British in each of these, the early Britishers,
yes.
See, that had gone out and gone direct in with them. I wasn't clear when the Albacete front had been set up, because at that time I got the impression, the Albacete base had been set up. I got the impression, although it was the International Brigade as such, that already there had passed through it the Talman and the other battalion, the French at least.
Mm.
See? And I know that there were other Slavs there as well, because I came across and got very friendly with a little Bulgarian representative, a base commissar from among the Bulgarians. So there were Bulgarians, Eastern Europeans there, and Poles. Of course, later, there was among the British, there were Cypriots and others. And among the Americans, there were Cubans and so on as well. Anyway, now, the battalion by this time would be probably around about 600. Mm-hmm. With my group, the number one company and the other volunteers that were trickling in, you know, in groups. Now, and in January, I forget the exact date, a big thing happened for us, because there they arrived, the packing cases with the new Russian rifles that were able to take out the cases when they were opened with the Vaseline on them and the long Russian bayonet. And they, you fired these rifles, by the way, with the bayonet on, you know. But they made a very big difference. You could see the morale, especially the number one company lads, jump. They also saw a Maxims, you know, which was a Russian rather old-fashioned heavy machine gun, but rather deadly when it was being used, especially if it wasn't too long a range.
What was the, if I may ask you, what was the structure of command in the British battalion at this point?
Well, the structure of command at this point was that each company had a company commander.
Mm-hmm.
There were NCOs below them. Above them, there was the battalion commander, the deputy commander, a second in command, and the battalion political commissar.
Mm-hmm. Now, at this point, who was the commander of the battalion?
McCartney.
And the deputy?
Tom Wintringham.
And you were the political
commander?
No.
Springhill was the battalion. I was the base commissar.
You were the base commissar, that's right. And the company commanders, can you remember who they were?
No, I can't remember. There was I think Jock Cunningham was a company commander in one company, and I think Fry was a commander of the machine gun company. Who was the other? I couldn't give you, at least honestly, but I know the names of a number like Briskey and the others, but I'm not sure. I can't give you now, and from memory, exactly the lower structure.
Yes.
Incidentally, it was about this time that Nathan was taken away and taken to the divisional headquarters. Nathan.
Yes.
He became a chief of staff to the division. Mm-hmm. And I think he was killed at Brunetti, was it? Melchiti. Brunetti or Melchiti later. He was a very, very brave man and a good soldier, the kind of bloke that worked with them and, how shall I put it, also by example as well as being disciplined.
Lots of other people have spoken very highly of Nathan.
Yes. I had quite an admiration for Swift. I've seen him in the action at the court at L'Opera. Now, I think I should mention here what happened in connection with McCartney and get the record straight.
Okay.
McCartney had to go back to England. He didn't ask to go back, but he had to go back. I understand it. No, I'm not certain of this. McCartney had done 9 years of his 12-year sentence for espionage for the... did you know that?
Yes.
And I understood it was ticket or leave, but it wasn't discussed. But he had to go back.
Just to explain, can you, what he'd done for this espionage?
I don't know. He'd done spying, apparently. He was found guilty of spying. He wrote a book afterwards, Walls of Mouths, which was a book of his experiences in prison.
Yes.
But he never discussed that, and I never discussed the thing, and I don't know whether he admitted he was guilty or not, but he was found guilty anyway. Anyway, he was going back, and I visited him in his room before he went back to have a talk with him about the situation, the battalion and so on. And the intention was that he would come back. Now, it wasn't too clear where he was going to be back in time for the going up to the front. Well, at that time, we didn't know exactly when they were going to go to the front. And they say this was around about mid-January. I haven't about exact dates. But he had a big, heavy revolver. And I had a rather small Belgian revolver. And he said, look, Peter, he says, what about giving me your revolver? I'm going through France. I don't want to hump this thing about. I say, all right. He says, well, maybe you'd let me see how you operate it. Well, I took the revolver in my hand, and what I can't say for sure is whether or not I touched the safety catch, whether it was off or not, or whether I touched the trigger. But suddenly there was a shot, and he said, oh, you've hit me in the arm. And I had hit him in the arm with the bullet from the small Belgian revolver. So I immediately got my doctor. It was in the hotel that he was living in at that time. And before he was back, he would been staying two or three days there. And we rushed him to hospital. They got the anti-tetanus injection, and he got patched up, and he went off.
Which part of the arm was it? Was it the right arm, you say, was it? You shot him in?
I think it was the right arm. I'm not absolutely certain, but it was in the arm.
Yeah.
Because he later appeared at Trafalgar Square at a big rally, and his arm was bandaged up.
And you're not quite sure why he went back?
No, I'm telling you what I was informed, but I wasn't informed that as a hard piece of evidence. I certainly know it wasn't to get him out of the command position. I'm certain of that. Although he was a rather, how shall I put it, rather a British military officer type of discipline in the battalion, you know.
Was he very popular with his men?
I wouldn't say he was terribly popular, no, but I think he was respected for his ability. No.
He was a good officer.
Well, he was a capable military officer, I would say. But he had this rather arrogant style, you know. This officer's style, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Anyway, that's the position about McCartney. And that is the actual fact. So you see, Thomas has got it wrong. I shot him in the leg. Now, of course, there's other said that I was given the job of getting rid of him by, isn't that right? Thomas says shot in the leg.
Yes. Shot in the leg.
Aye. But and people, there must be photographs of him at the Trafalgar Square demonstration. Anyway, these are the facts. I have nothing to be specially hide about it. It was an accident. I was partly responsible for the thing. In fact, in the last analysis, wholly responsible for making such a mistake. It might have been worse too. Now, then came the order to move up to the front.